Greetings once again to all of you out there from right here in the Greetings once again to all of you out there from right here in the middle of it all. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the world view. It is the Weekly Worldview, and I am your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back to the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. It's the show that goes worldwide, unconstrained by the traditional bounds of the broadcast media. It is the Weekly Worldview. So glad to have you back. And I guess I need to start with just a little bit of housekeeping. I'm afraid I've been informed by numerous listeners that I misspoke last week. That's right, I misspoke in stating that the election theft being engineered in Alaska against one Joe Miller by Lisa Murkowski was being engineered by the Democrat Party. Is that what I said? Well, I went back and listened, and that's what I said. And I don't know how it is that I possibly could have confused the Republican Party up there in Alaska with the Democrats, but apparently I did so. And I apologize for that. So please forgive me. And as you know, I have been soliciting advice from friends, listeners, even enemies, as to the wisdom and necessity of making the switch from a PC to a Mac. And I have not yet done so. The main reason being, last week, I went to the Apple Store. And how do I put this? Well, first of all, upon entering the Apple Store, there was such a hiss in the air, I thought perhaps there was gas escaping. But it turned out the place was just filled with homos and weirdos. And the freak factor in the Apple Store at our local mall has caused me to reconsider throwing in with that crowd. I mean, the greeter at the Apple Store had those giant black earlobe stretching grommets in his ears, and he's greeting me as if he's a legitimate business person. And he had the little scraggly goatee and that medical marijuana glazed look, and I'm just not sure that I can do this. I may stay with the PC just based on the freak factor alone at the Apple Store. So I come to you this week yet again via PC, Toshiba, as a matter of fact. And, I'm having a hard time taking that step. Let's just put it that way. And I'll just leave it at that, but I do solicit and invite any advice that anyone would give me on how do I swallow hard and throw in with the whole Apple crowd. You know, I never liked their logo either. You know, they've got the rainbow apple with a bite taken out of it. I just don't like that. I mean, I think I know what they're trying to imply there. And I just don't roll like that. You know what I'm saying. Anyway, so on to the PC we go here. And well, let's get to some serious news, for crying out loud, as if you care what's going on in my pathetic little life. Let's start in Boca Raton, Florida. This is an AP Wire report. Boca Raton police officer Jimmy Jaleel says he and another man stopped at a flaming car accident and tried to break a window to free a victim from the flames. After nearly a dozen attempts to break the window, the 32-year-old police officer decided to use his gun. He ordered everyone to the back and fired two shots. I'm sorry, he ordered everyone back and fired two shots into the rear passenger window of the car. The dash-mounted police camera captured Jaleel, then clearing the window of glass and pulling the woman out of the flaming car to safety. Now, I do this story off the top for a couple of reasons. Number one, I don't want you to lose hope, ladies and gentlemen. This is America, and there still are real men out there who can help preserve the nation as we head into this time of trouble that we're headed into here. So fear not. And I also do it just to tweak the gun controllers out there, because you know they hate this story. Because you know what a gun controller says about gun control laws? Well, even if it saves just one life, isn't it worth it? Isn't it? And here's a case where having a gun saved a life. And I always like a story like that, especially to kick off this week's broadcast. All right, so that's pretty much all we have. The woman, apparently, lost control, hit a utility pole, the car burst into flames. But due to the quick reaction, the cat-like reflexes of Officer Jaleel, she is expected to recover fully from minor injuries. And that's just fantastic. Thank you, Officer Jaleel, for at least giving us some hope for the near future. Anyways, all right. Now on to the politics file. And it gets deep in the politics file, folks. Put on your boots. Put on your waders, because we're going to go to the Cancun Climate Change Summit. It's coming up soon. And according to the Telegraph in London, in a series of papers published by the Royal Society, which are physicists and chemists from what they allege are the world's most respected scientific institutions, including Oxford and the Met Office, well, they've agreed that current plans to tackle global warming are not enough. Unless emissions are reduced dramatically in the next 10 years, the world is set to see temperatures rise by more than 4 degrees Celsius as early as the 2060s, causing floods, droughts, and mass migration. So we have to have a meeting. So where better to have a meeting on global warming than Cancun, Mexico? So that's where they're all going to get together here shortly. In one paper, Professor Kevin Anderson, director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research, said the only way to reduce emissions enough while allowing the poor nations to continue to grow is to halt economic growth in the rich world over the next 20 years. Pretty simple solution. Why didn't I think of that? Let's halt all economic growth amongst what he calls the rich world. That's you. This particular scientist, Kevin Anderson, he said politicians should consider a rationing system similar to the one introduced during the last time of crisis, the 1930s and 40s. He says, quote, "The Second World War and the concept of rationing is something we need to seriously consider if we are to address the scale of the problem we face." It's just scary, isn't it, folks? I'm getting scared just reading this article. Now, the last rounds of talks, according to the Telegraph, in Copenhagen last year, ended in a weak political accord to keep temperature rise below the dangerous tipping point of 2 degrees Celsius. Now, this time, they're getting together again, all the climate change mongers, fear mongers, and this time, according to the Telegraph, 194 countries are meeting again to try to make the deal they agreed to last time legally binding. They want to make that deal legally binding and agree on several items, including cutting emissions and funding next year's meeting and improving the general quality of the lobster and the prostitutes at next year's meeting. Apparently that's on the agenda at the Cancun Climate Change Summit coming up down there in beautiful Cancun, Mexico. So be afraid. Be very afraid. Now, deeper into the politics file, we go to CBS News. At a town hall meeting appearance in Manama, Bahrain, last Friday, Hillary Clinton denied any intention to run for president. She said, quote, "I think I will serve as Secretary of State as my last public position." You see, when her current position is over, everyone is wondering, will Clinton run against Barry? Will Hillary run against Sarah in 2012? Well, Clinton says no. She says she would like to continue working to, quote, improve lives for others. Hillary has always been concerned mostly about others, as you can tell from her political career and the wreckage that she has left upon the political scene over the last 30 years. Her concern for others, well, has just about destroyed the country. She says that she will, quote, probably go back to advocacy work, particularly on women and children, and probably around the world. That's what Hillary says she's going to do, rather than run against Barry in a primary in 2012. The CBS News reminds us that Mrs. Clinton has formerly worked extensively for the rights of women and children. And boy, that makes me feel so good about Hillary. We're going to come back to this story a little bit later. But just to close, listen to what Hillary Clinton had to say about the presidency. She said, quote, "Every president, if you watch what they look like when they come into office, you can see their hair turn white because it's such a hard job." Aw, Hill, that's just like a girl. Such a hard job. I'm sure she'll land on her feet wherever she ends up. Speaking of wherever she ends up, it seems Hillary's in quite a bit of debt. Still, yes, left over after she was abandoned en masse by the Democrat base for one Barack Barry Ho Hussein Obama. And she apparently has a large amount of campaign debt that she's still trying to take care of. And listen to where Hillary has ended up. On her feet on the Home Shopping Network. According to U.S. News and World Report, Hillary Clinton remains in debt and has gone on the Home Shopping Network to raise money selling signed copies of a DVD recording of her most recent Democratic National Convention speech. In the infomercial, Hillary begs with a repeat of one of her famous speech lines. She says, quote, "You never gave in. You never gave up. And together we made history." And there's supposed to be thunderous applause after that. But I find myself saying, what? Huh? History? How did you make history, Hillary? By becoming the second woman to be embarrassed politically by a man in either a primary or a general election? I guess. I suppose it's history. I mean, maybe you could say everything is history. There's just the fact that she showed up made history, I suppose. But I don't know. I find that fairly dubious. The infomercial in which Hillary participates ends by saying, if you will donate $50, you get a DVD of the speech. And if you act now in the next 5 minutes, pay $250, and that comes with a signature DVD. But act now because there are only 50 DVDs available. Phones are open now. Start dialing. Dial in the next 2 minutes. There are only 50 of the signature DVDs remaining. Now let's do the math on this. She got 50 signed DVDs. She says she's only got 50 of those. Sell them at $250 a piece. Carry the two. That's $12,500. That doesn't seem like an awful lot of money for someone like Hill. And the amount of her debt, well, they don't go into it here in the article, but from what I understood, it was in the millions of dollars. And she's only going to do 50 of those DVDs. Uh-huh. Okay. Well, we'll keep an eye on that for you. No, actually, we won't. We pretty much ignore Hillary as much as we can. As we move forward, deeper into the politics file, I hope you've got your waders on. This is from WorldNet Daily in a classified diplomatic cable. One John Kerry was quoted as saying, quote, "Yasser Arafat went from living as a terrorist in Tunisia to signing an agreement with Israel on the White House lawn. The transformation of Arafat is an example of how actors in the region need to take risks if we are to move forward in advancing regional peace, unquote. That's John Kerry remarking on Yasser Arafat's amazing transformation from terrorist to virtual saint in the Democrat lexicon. Kerry, according to WorldNet Daily, implied Arafat was transformed into a statesman after he signed the Oslo Accord on the White House lawn. Yeah. Kerry was speaking to a bunch of Muslims, and he had a meeting with a gentleman named Al-Thani. And I'm not sure who this fella is, this Al-Thani. I didn't mark this up well enough. But anyway, Kerry's talking to a bunch of Muslims, so naturally he prevaricates, and he sucks up to whoever's in the room because he's a typical American politician. In his meeting with this one particular Muslim, Kerry went on to support the Israeli relinquishment of the strategic Golan Heights to Syria. He also stated Palestinian control of the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Temple Mount and a capital in eastern Jerusalem are non-negotiable for Palestinians. So it's weird. Yasser Arafat, in Kerry's mind, was transformed from a terrorist to a statesman. And John Kerry, in my mind, is transforming from a fairly embarrassing statesman to a supporter of fairly effective terrorists. All right, so Weekly Worldview, thank you again so much for coming along on this week's ride into reality. And that brings us to a story that is very real and very shocking, at least to me. I got a couple of articles here. The first is dated Thursday, December 2nd, 2010, a little earlier this week. Thursday, according to an article from Bloomberg News, aircraft from Europe arrived in Israel today, Thursday, December 2nd, to help combat a forest fire near the port city of Haifa in Israel that has killed at least 41 people and forced 15,000 to flee from their homes. That's right. This is last Thursday. 8 planes and 3 helicopters arrived from Greece, Bulgaria, Cyprus, and the United Kingdom. And then a bunch of other countries, Russia, Azerbaijan, Egypt, Romania, have also pledged to send aircraft after Benjamin Netanyahu issued a formal request for help in the face of the nation's worst fire disaster in recent memory. The fire began around midday on December 2nd. Now get this, folks. The fire began at midday, let's say noonish, on December 2nd. By the end of the day, 8 aircraft had arrived from Greece, Bulgaria, Cyprus, and the United Kingdom. Why were American firefighters or firefighting capabilities not there the same day? Can you answer me that question? And for those of you out there who feel like we should never help Israel in any way, I know there are those of you out there, and I myself, I'm against writing checks, blank checks to Israel and giving foreign aid to Israel. I'm not for all of that. But here we have a genuine catastrophe. And on the day of the fire, and folks, when there's a fire and you need help, that day is really important because it's a fire. Okay? When you need help with a fire, you generally need it that day or sooner because it's a fire, for crying out loud. Well, on the day of the fire, Barry Ho, your president and mine, sent his thoughts and prayers to Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli people who were being burned there on Mount Carmel in Israel. Now, fast forward to the next day. Friday, December 3rd, the Obama administration has announced that the U.S. is sending firefighters and supplies to Israel. They should arrive sometime over this weekend. Barry, it's a fire. It's a fire, Barry. When you need help on a fire, you generally can't wait until the weekend. Anyway, so for any Jews that are listening and any Israel supporters out there, of which you can count me as one, I support Israel's right to exist. This, for all of you Israelis in the audience, this is when you find out who your friends are. When there is a massive fire, who sends you planes that day and firefighting equipment, and who sends their thoughts and prayers? That's the difference between who's your enemy and who's your friend. The people who send their thoughts and prayers and who pledge to help, they're not your friends. The people who actually send troops and supplies and firefighting equipment that day, well, those are your friends. And folks, this is the type of diplomatic effort that American leadership should exploit whenever and wherever possible, not only in Israel, but any country that has a natural disaster. America should be the first to help. And we could do that if we weren't so busy frittering away all of our money on stupid other things. If we weren't so busy running around the world, nation building, and buying off politicians and importing opium or whatever it is we're running around the world doing these days, maybe we could have some resources in place. Because you know what, folks? When you go into another country that is experiencing a catastrophe and you help them, that builds a lot of diplomatic capital. Anyway, but you know what? I'll bet there were Americans. And if the fire is still burning, I didn't check at last before we went to press here. But I'm sure there were Americans fighting that fire in Israel, but simply doing it in an unofficial capacity. I'm sure there were Americans there. But we missed a tremendous opportunity to show the world why America is still a great world leader that comes to the aid and defense of its friends in a time of crisis. And Barry Ho has squandered yet more diplomatic capital, and he's been squandering everything he can get his hands on just about as fast as he can, and it's pretty disturbing. But let's move to a more local note. And if you disagree with me, well, you're probably just not that well informed. You need to do a little more reading. But let's move now to a story that's near and dear to my heart. It relates to the Innocence Project. You know that's one of my favorite topics. Barry Shuck and Jive Sheck and all of his Shuck and Jive lawyers at the Innocence Project. Well, here's what's happened down in Dallas. A Texas man who spent 21 years in prison for murder was freed from prison and granted a new trial by DNA evidence that showed his original conviction was tainted. Clay Cabot. But Clay Cabot has now, just this past week, pleaded guilty in that same case. He's pled guilty to murdering Galua Crosby, who was found in her Garland home, tied up and gagged with 3 gunshot wounds to the head. Now, Cabot was first convicted of the crime in 1986, in part by testimony from his brother-in-law, Gerald Pabst, who said on the stand that Cabot raped and shot the victim. But a 2007 DNA test excluded Cabot and linked the brother-in-law to the crime. Now, Pabst had already cut a deal with prosecutors to testify against his brother-in-law, and he was convicted of capital murder back in 08 and sentenced to life. Now, the Innocence Project went in 2007. They did the DNA test. Cabot won his freedom in a new trial. But the district attorney there in Dallas insisted that both men killed Crosby. Now, Cabot had maintained his innocence, especially when in the presence of Barry Shuck and Jive Sheck. He had maintained his innocence right up until last Friday when he cut a deal to plead guilty for time served. So basically, the Innocence Project got him off, and then he admitted that, yeah, he actually participated in the murder but only after he was able to cut a deal with the hapless prosecutors there in Dallas, Texas. A spokesperson, a spokes attorney for the Innocence Project says that this was an unusual case for the New York-based Innocence Project, which, as its name suggests, does not typically represent clients who plead guilty to murder. No. So the killer copped a guilty plea after the so-called Innocence Project sprung. Why did he cop a guilty plea? Well, because like most of the people that the Innocence Project deals with, he was guilty. And that's all there is to it. Anyway, we'll sort all that out on Judgment Day when everything comes out. Barry Scheck will be fairly embarrassed. Well, actually, I don't know if he's capable of that. Anyway, on deeper into the justice file from New Haven, Connecticut. This is a story from the Associated Press. Stephen Hayes, you remember Stephen Hayes, the murderer who participated in a home invasion, knocked out the father, tied up the daughters, forced the mom to withdraw money, and then burned them all to death in their own home. You remember Stephen Hayes. Well, he was found guilty, and the jury recommended death. Well, he's made his first public comments about the case before being formally sentenced to death this past week. Here's what Stephen Hayes has to say. Quote, "I am deeply sorry for what I've done and the pain I've caused. My actions have hurt so many people, affected so many lives and caused so much pain. I am tormented, and I have nightmares about what happened in that house. But," he says, "this was not the real me. This was an angry monster that I've never known, a monster so full of rage it was impossible to control." That's what he says. "Death for me," says Hayes, "death for me will be a welcome relief, and I hope it will bring some peace and comfort to those I have hurt so much." Okay? So do you feel any pity, any sympathy for Mr. Hayes? Did you hear my extremely attractive audio engineer burst out laughing? Did you hear that? That is a reasonable response to a cold-blooded murderer who is seeking mercy at his sentencing. But I want to ask you in the audience, do you feel any pity? Do you feel any mercy for Stephen Hayes? Well, I don't. And I admit that I do not have the capacity to feel any compassion for Mr. Hayes, and I certainly don't have the authority to forgive Mr. Hayes for what he's done. Only Jesus Christ has the capacity and the authority to forgive Mr. Hayes. That's why he's Jesus Christ. That's one of the reasons. That's why he's not like us. We don't have the capacity. I want to kill this guy with my bare hands. I don't care if he's begging me for mercy. But Jesus Christ has the capacity, not only the capacity for forgiveness for Stephen Hayes, he has the authority and the ability to do it. My advice to the justice system participants there in New Haven, kill this guy now. It's his best chance at repentance. Kill him now while he's in this state of mind. And there's a chance he could actually repent and be saved from the fire that is coming. Now, just to close this out, according to the AP, Hayes will join 9 other men on Connecticut's death row. The state has only executed one man since 1960. So the 47-year-old Hayes will likely spend years, if not decades, in prison, giving him ample opportunity to justify himself, to grow angry with an unjust justice system, and eventually to reject his only shot at true repentance. That's what Hayes is in for. And it's just sad. All right. Okay, we got more justice. The justice file is pretty thick this week. Oh, here we go. Here we go. San Francisco. Judge Stephen Reinhart, this is from the Associated Press, Judge Stephen Reinhart of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has denied a request that he recuse himself from the homosexual marriage case, Prop 8, because he is married to Ramona Ripston, who plans to retire in February as head of the American Civil Liberties Union, Southern California office. So the judge in the gay marriage case is married to the head of an ACLU branch out in Southern California. The ACLU, according to the AP, is an outspoken opponent of Proposition 8 and a proponent of homosexual marriage, as you can imagine. So some folks said, Judge, you know, you're married to this spokes-dyke lawyer for the ACLU. How can you really be impartial in judging this homosexual marriage case? Well, the judge, after thoughtful review, has decided not to recuse himself, and he will judge to legalize homosexual marriage out in California. And by the way, the Associated Press reminds us that Judge Reinhart is most famous. What's he most famous for? For voting with the majority in ruling the Pledge of Allegiance's Under God clause to be in violation of the Constitution. So that's who we've got now who's going to judge this homo marriage case, a guy who thought saying under God violated the Constitution. I'm not sure how he feels about men violating one another in a grotesque manner, if that violates the Constitution. I'm sure he does not. And I'm sure he's in full agreement with his deviant wife. All right, now from that story to something that's even more disgusting, if that's possible. I mean, just imagining a judge married to a lawyer who's the head of an ACLU branch, that's enough to make you want to puke. But listen to this. From The Guardian in London. Foreign contractors employed to train Afghan policemen apparently took drugs and paid for young dancing boys. Dancing boys, I said, to entertain them in northern Afghanistan. This is according to one of the U.S. Embassy cables released by the fellows over there at WikiLeaks. So when I read the headline, I'm thinking, dancing boys? What are you talking about, dancing boys? Well, listen to this. There's a long tradition in Afghanistan of young boys dressing up as girls and dancing for grown men. This is the culture in Afghanistan that we went in to save from the Taliban. The Guardian says that this dancing boys tradition is an activity that sometimes crosses the line into child abuse when the Afghan men keep the dancing boys as possessions. I know. Ew. And so here we've got some of our contractors from over here in America who hired the dancing boys. And no word on yet as to whether or not they kept any of them. Let's hope not. But my. I mean, if this is nation building, I mean, just count me out. This is just disgusting. And so let me talk, this is from the WikiLeaks. So the WikiLeaks is the big story of the week. And I want to give you my take on this whole WikiLeaks fiasco. Not as if you'd asked for it or even care. But you're listening to the show, so you're going to get my view on it. I think Julian Assange is, he's the student, or perhaps the child, whose parents have raised him to distrust and question all authority and not to trust anyone. They bred this attitude into him. His parents, his education, the culture in general. Don't trust anyone over 30. All of that. And Assange is just living out to the extreme the lessons that the agitators, the socialist agitators in society have taught him. Don't trust anyone. And they told him not to trust anyone, and now Julian is going to show us all why we can't trust anyone. By exposing the culture of lies that is modern social democratic governance, his goal is, I believe, the same one that Hillary Clinton and Barry Ho both chanted in college. And that's to bring it all down, man. It is the Weekly Worldview, and I am your host, Doug McBurney. And, you know, speaking of WikiLeaks and the whole internet thing, you know, a lot of people have been warning me and the world, and anyone who will listen, that Google is evil, and they're trying to take over the world and control everything, and control information, what we see and what we learn. And I've got to tell you that I never much cared. But I went on Google earlier this week because I wanted to get together a list of all the proof text in the Bible that basically gives God's opinion about homosexuality. And so I typed into the search line on Google, I typed in homosexuality proof texts. And what I got was page after page after page of homosexual advocacy from a Christian perspective. I didn't have the time to drill down far enough to find a list of proof texts that actually state the opinion of our Creator about deviating from His sexual design that He designed in order to preserve the race, for crying out loud. So anyway, Google is evil. Are they trying to take over everything? I don't know. Are they controlling information as to what we hear? Yes. And what we see? Yes, they are. So there, for whatever that's worth. And I don't know. Can anyone suggest another search engine that may be skewed toward right instead of toward queers? I would appreciate it because I'd like to use that search engine. What annoys me is the folks at Google are so good at what they do and then so devious and wicked in what they promote. It's sad. But it's not really surprising, I suppose. Can you imagine if the computer industry had started somewhere other than Sodom West up there in the Silicon Valley? Can you imagine how robust the computer industry would be had it started in Wilmington, North Carolina, instead of San Francisco? Can you imagine how much our information technology has been retarded by the fact that it's run by a bunch of deviants? I mean, what if it was run by real red-blooded American men? You know, the men who built the hydroelectric dams, the men who built the interstate freeway system, the men who built the auto industry. I think we'd be doing better. I wouldn't be struggling between PC or Mac. It would all be working so much better. Anyway, I'm getting off on a tangent here. All right. Now, why was I looking up proof texts on homosexuality? Because I've been engaged in a debate with some fellows on the radio who say we can't repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell because it'll harm the military. And I've been asking them, don't you guys remember back in 1992 when we said you can't implement Don't Ask, Don't Tell because it'll harm the military? Because we can't have queers serving in the military, period. Open, closed, it doesn't matter. We cannot promote deviant sexual behavior in the military. We should not. That's all there is to it. And now the left has moved the goalposts again, and conservatives are arguing that we need to retain Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and it makes me want to pull my hair out. But anyway, in researching the story, I came across this. Now, this is from WorldNet Daily. Who is responsible for the WikiLeaks episode? Well, one of those who is facing charges is one PFC Bradley Manning. PFC Bradley Manning was a 22-year-old intelligence analyst. My first question, how can anyone who is 22 years old be an intelligence analyst? They don't even have any intelligence at 22. But here he was. And PFC Bradley Manning was a homosexual, well, is a homosexual. And he was provided access to top national security secrets, hundreds of thousands of classified documents, which he released to Mr. Assange and the WikiLeaks organization over there. His friends in the army knew he was a homosexual, but nobody asked, and nobody told, according to WorldNet Daily. And here's how the New York Times told the story last August. The New York Times said, but it was around 2 years ago when PFC Bradley Manning came to Cambridge, Massachusetts to visit a man he had fallen in love with. and that he finally seemed to have found a place where he fit in, part of a social circle that included politically motivated computer hackers and his boyfriend, a self-described drag queen. So when his military career seemed headed nowhere good, Private Manning turned increasingly to those friends for moral support. And now, some of those friends say they wonder whether his desperation for acceptance or delusions of grandeur may have led him to disclose the largest trove of government secrets since the Pentagon Papers. So here you've got a homosexual who started running with a bunch of other homo hackers. And, well, we can see what's happening. I mean, whether no matter how you feel about WikiLeaks, it is shaking the world. It is agitating and shaking the world. It is shaking the confidence of the world, as well it should. But I wanted to tell you that story because those are undisputed facts, despite the fact that they were reported in the New York Times. WorldNet Daily double and triple checked their sourcing. And these are undisputed facts. Manning, who worked for Assange at WikiLeaks, is a homosexual. He was dating a drag queen. Well, last week, a Pentagon study came out. You've all heard about it. It's a study on gays in the military and repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Well, surprise, surprise, surprise. The study has determined that overturning the Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Seek, Don't Smell policy might cause some disruption at first, but would not create widespread or long-lasting problems. So we've got one homosexual with a drag queen boyfriend who is literally shaking the world with what he's done. And that same week, we have the Pentagon release a report that says, well, letting homosexuals serve, it's not going to hurt any. Maybe a few bumps in the road, but no problem. Unbelievable. I mean, how do they do this with a straight face? I mean, we all knew that this was a kangaroo court from the beginning. We knew that this study was simply stagecraft to satisfy Republicans like John McCain, who in their heart of hearts don't particularly care that homosexuals could destroy the country and all of civilization. He really doesn't care. What he cares about is his political future. Anyway, the co-chairs of the study, Pentagon General Counsel Jay Johnson and General Carter Ham, they wrote, quote, "We are both convinced that our military can do this, even during a time of war." What's that? Repeal the rule that you can't openly declare yourself a homosexual in the military. They say we can do it. The very same week a homosexual is shaking the world from its foundations. Shaking military intelligence to its core. Diplomatic and military intelligence. The survey found 2/3 of the troops don't care if the ban is lifted. 40% of combat troops said the acceptance of gays serving openly would be a bad idea. Listen, this is what really hurt me the most. 58% of Marines serving in combat roles said that they'd rather not serve with open fags. Only 58% of the Marine Corps, for crying out loud. We've definitely lost a generation. It's sad. We've lost a generation. When less than 60% of the Marine Corps is against buggery, by golly, we are in trouble, folks. Trouble with a capital T, and that rhymes with me, and I don't want no fags in my Marine Corps. I've done it again. I've stumbled on into the final segment of the show, and I've just got so much stuff I want to get to. Let's go to the Domestic Tranquility File. Two stories from the AP First. Celebration, Florida, Celebration is Disney's master plan, picture-perfect Central Florida community, and it had never reported a homicide in its 14-year existence until now. A 58-year-old neighbor who lived alone with his chihuahua there in Celebration, Florida, had been slain over the long Thanksgiving weekend, and his body was discovered a few years ago. According to AP, a resident joked with a reporter that Celebration would feel like a real town when a bike was stolen. Well, now it has an unsolved killing on its hands. But officials were quick to soothe the residents, saying, quote, "We don't believe the safety of the residents is in jeopardy." Yeah, so. 2 days later, Celebration, Florida. The owner of a failed securities business barricaded himself in his soon-to-be foreclosed home and shot at deputies and then killed himself just days after the town's first ever homicide. So, the celebration is over, ladies and gentlemen. We're getting down to nitty-gritty, ugly reality, even in Celebration, Florida. This fellow who shot at cops and then killed himself, he was in the middle of a divorce. So in the course of 1 week, you have murder, you have attempted murder, you have suicide, and of course you have divorce lurking there in the background in Celebration, Florida, bringing them back down to reality. All right, let's go to, from the justice file, Granite, Oklahoma. A man serving 30 years in prison for the murder of an Oklahoma County sheriff has been moved to solitary in a different prison after he used a smuggled-in cell phone to post pictures and comments on Facebook. Yeah, a corrections department spokesman there in Oklahoma says officials found marijuana in his cell. And this guy, I don't know. They say they're going to punish him, but what do you do to a guy who's serving 30? What are the odds this guy's going to repent? Pretty much nil. Getting stoned and posting on Facebook. He doesn't even realize he's done anything wrong, for crying out loud. Meanwhile, out in Los Angeles, from the LA Times, the murderous cult leader Charles Manson was one of thousands of California inmates busted with a cell phone last year, which Manson used to call unidentified people in California, New Jersey, Florida, and British Columbia. Said one Terry Thornton, a spokeswoman for the California Department of Corrections. She said, quote, "It's troubling that he had a cell phone since he's a person who got other people to murder on his behalf." Yeah. Troubling, Terry? I think maybe it's more than troubling that Charles Manson had a cell phone. Maybe a little more than troubling, for crying out loud. All right, and here's some interesting statistics, just in case you were wondering how insane things have gotten. California guards found 1,400 cell phones in prisons back in 07, 7,000 in 2009, and almost 9,000 this year. And you know what? They can't punish the prisoners because the prisons are already overcrowded, so they just give them a reprimand, whatever that is. I think that's what Charlie Rangel got. It's where they say, you did something bad, we're not going to do anything to you, don't do it again. Prisoners with cell phones, for crying out loud. You'll remember that Manson ordered the ritualistic murders of actress Sharon Tate and six others back in 1969. This is a fellow who manipulated other people to murder on his behalf. He's got a cell phone in prison, for crying out loud. Has anyone been fired? Of course not. Let's move on to Texas. This is from The Smoking Gun. James Tyler Merkel of 20 received a 5-year sentence last Tuesday in Angelina County Court. Merkel will soon be transported from the county jail to the Texas State Penitentiary at Huntsville. He's a phone prankster, and they're sending him to Huntsville with drug dealers, rapists, and murderers. And Huntsville, by the way, they remind us, is the home of Death Row. His aunt told a TV reporter that he was a very nice and respectful young man. She'd never known him to be in any trouble before. Now, here's what he did. He made a crank call to a McDonald's that ended up in a riot and $5,000 in damage to the McDonald's there in Lufkin, Texas. But his aunt says he was a good boy. By the way, Merkel was convicted as a juvenile of raping a 5-year-old girl in the bathroom of a Baptist church. He spent 30 months in a youth detention facility, and he should have been put to death. More from the Domestic Tranquility File as we round third and we are headed for home. This is from Las Vegas, Nevada, from the Public School File. The Las Vegas Review-Journal reports a Clark County grand jury handed up an indictment last Wednesday accusing 19-year-old Saul Favela of leading three 20-year-olds and two 16-year-olds on a violent robbery spree in a northwest Las Vegas community until they came upon 50-year-old Timothy Vanderbosch. Back on October 20th, investigators say Vanderbosch tried to run after he was first attacked, but the group chased him, beat him into unconsciousness, and left him in a street where he was struck by a passing truck. Vanderbosch later died. Authorities say the group of youngsters was into random violence. My. Products of the public school. More from the Domestic Tranquility File. Video of a fight between Joshua Poole, a 13-year-old, and his middle school classmate shows Poole swinging wildly as he is punched repeatedly before falling to the floor. The teacher apparently sat there. If you watch the video, the teacher literally sits at the desk while this student is being pummeled into the ground. The teacher's inaction was reportedly due to a school policy that staff can only intervene in a fight if they've undergone the proper training, and this teacher hadn't gotten trained how to break up a fight between two 13-year-olds. Palm Beach County School District officials insist the teacher followed procedure and that he was not properly trained per district protocol to break up such an altercation. Well, the kid who was beaten into the ground, his father, he told the TV station there in Palm Beach that the fight came after previous incidents of bullying, and he said, quote, "This keeps happening, you know? It's the same thing. Somebody will just come up behind my son and start brutalizing him. I send my kids to school to get educated, not to get killed. This is really bad," unquote. Well, yeah, Dad. It's really bad that you're sending your kid to this school, you moron. I mean, how many times does your son have to be punched in the head before you realize you are putting him in danger by sending him to the government school factory? You moron. This father needs to be slapped upside the head for crying out loud. All right. More from the... From Charleston, South Carolina, an 18-month-old South Carolina boy is in critical condition after authorities say he was hanged by his ankles in a closet and repeatedly beaten by three teenagers. Three teenagers, products of your public schools, ladies and gentlemen, ages 14, 15, and 16, are accused of abusing 18-month-old Lewis Wright of Charleston, South Carolina. The child's mother has also been charged with allowing the beatings to occur. The mother brought the little 18-month-old to a hospital with a swollen face, fractured ribs, bruises, and lacerations to his spleen, liver, and pancreas. The teenagers say that they were just play wrestling. Yeah. So here we have women and children in a crisis situation. Maybe this could be Hillary's first case. Let's see here. Go back to this. Hillary plans to go back to work for the Children's Defense Fund. Perhaps this could be her first case, and she could make the argument. She could ask the question. The obvious question here for Hillary would be, did the 18-month-old's mother have access to safe, low-cost abortion? And furthermore, what about the three teenagers' mothers? Did they have access to safe, low-cost abortion? Because if they did, certainly this entire incident could have been avoided. Your Honor, I thank you very much. Yeah. Hillary's going to advocate for women and children. Yeah. From Tyson's Corner, Virginia, from the Domestic Tranquility File, WTOP reports Carmela De La Rosa allegedly threw 2.5-year-old Angelina Ogdok off the 6th-floor outdoor walkway at Tyson's Corner Center around 7:15 p.m. last Monday. The 2.5-year-old was pronounced dead. Police have not said what prompted De La Rosa to hurt her granddaughter. Her granddaughter. She threw her granddaughter off a sixth-floor walkway. And authorities are confused as to why. Why could this possibly happen in a country that so values the lives of its children that they dehumanize them and allow them to be butchered? How could something like this possibly happen? Now let's go to our fine neighbor to the north, our Canadian friends from Toronto, Canada. A Canadian man was charged with first-degree murder last Friday for fatally shooting his father in the back with a crossbow. A crossbow, I said, in a Toronto library. Now, what bugged me about this article immediately, well, the fact that a man shot his father with a crossbow, that's pretty disturbing. But the headline says, Canadian uses crossbow to kill another man. Well, it was his father. That doesn't make the headline? It was his father, for crying out loud. Zhu Fang, that's the fella's name, I can't help it. Zhu Fang appeared in court a day after Si Cheng was killed in the library with a crossbow. Toronto police said Cheng was pronounced dead at the scene and Fang was arrested later in a Toronto suburb. The popular neighborhood library was busy with its after-school mother and children program as the man chased his father with a crossbow and shot him to death in front of them all. Now, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police reports that the only crossbows prohibited in Canada are those that can be fired with one hand and are 19 inches or less in length. Those are the only crossbows that are banned in Canada. A license or registration certificate is not required to own crossbows longer than 19 inches that require two hands to use. Such crossbows are sold in hunting shops across Canada. Folks, this is from the Associated Press. Leave it to the Associated Press to write an article about a man killing his own father, and leave it to the AP to focus on the crossbow. Unbelievable. All right. By the way, this is not the first incident involving crossbows in Canada. In 1991, a woman was shot dead by her estranged husband with a crossbow in Ottawa. And a father was charged in July with wounding his 36-year-old son with a crossbow in British Columbia. That's for all you gun control advocates out there. All right, finally, from WorldNet Daily, there is a billboard campaign going on. I'm sure you've heard of it. It's from the atheists, and it depicts a silhouette of the three wise men approaching a manger alongside the words, "You know it's a myth. This season, celebrate reason." Now, the atheists say that the billboard is meant to encourage fellow disbelievers who are going through the motions of celebrating Christmas to just stop it. The billboard is also meant to attack the myth that Christianity owns the solstice season and to raise the awareness of the organization and the movement, according to a statement on the group's website. The latter, being the main reason for the billboard, is to promote the organization. Anyway, American Atheists, Inc. Got a response. This week, from an outspoken evangelist named Ray Comfort. He says, God bless American Atheists, Inc. They're very generous people. He says, in April of 2001, they flew me 3,000 miles from California to Florida to speak at their annual convention. They kindly put me up in a luxury hotel, gave me a large fruit basket, let me preach the entire gospel, and also allowed me to make my books available to their people. So let's support American Atheists, Inc. for their efforts and pray that people who see their signs asking them to reason rather than just accept things on blind faith. Ray Comfort says it is atheism that is based on fairy tales and myths, notions like evolution. Ray says that to believe that nothing created everything is to lack that necessary reason of which American atheists speak. And Comfort says he suggests a new slogan for believers: atheistic evolution. You know it's a myth. This season, celebrate reason. And we will, and we thank Ray for thanking the atheists for spending the money to put up the billboards that make morons think. Because that you've got to get the morons' attention before you can let them know about the gospel and the fact that they're on their way straight to hell with jet rockets. But there is salvation from the fire that's coming. It's available only in Jesus Christ. That's right. All right, that's it for the Weekly Worldview. I will be back next week, should the Lord tarry. And until then, well, I want to thank my friends at KGOV.com. I want to thank my friends at Denver Bible Church, TheologyOnline.com, American Right to Life, and of course, as always, my other brother, Darrow, who makes it all happen here in the Weekly Worldview Studios. I will be back next week, and until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.